Here we go, March 8, 2009, lecture discussion number 83 on Genesis 1 through 19. So this is the 83rd in the series. And as usual, if you've missed the first 82, it's going to be a rough day. I announced last Sunday that we have entered the final throes of Genesis 15, which is attempting the two birds, the solution to the mystery of the two birds, knowing that first and always first, every time first, the two birds, like everything else in the Old Testament, they portray Jesus Christ. They teach of His person, His work. They testify of Him. They are part of the take me. When He says, how can you know you're going to be saved? Or when He answers that great question of Abraham, He says, take me. The two birds are part of the take me. And always never not remember that. Thank you. Two birds, I'm going to make the case eventually, is the hypostatic union. But again, remember that all of it testifies of Christ. It is the Christology, the John 5:39 that's so important, or the Christology of those two undivided birds. Anyway, beginning our analysis of the two birds, we did the same thing that we did with the heifer and the goat and the ram. We collected the scriptures that add, that illuminate, that also contain two bird references, and we placed them all side by side and began to look at the totality of all of it. And immediately Leviticus 14 came, as you know, as you remember, and I try to remind you, the cleansing ritual of the healed leper. Leviticus 14. The fact there is a healed leper is extraordinary, and you never want to set that aside, but we noted this cleansing ritual of the healed leper, which then sent us back or reminded us of the two goats of Yom Kippur, because as with the two birds, I've got two goats. In Leviticus 14, I have a live bird and a dead bird. In Leviticus 16, Yom Kippur, I have a live goat and a dead goat. So almost immediately, we note that there's something about the goats and the bird, or the birds and the goat, that are connected. One goat being the slain one for YHVH, and the released goat for Azazel. So, are the birds the same, is the obvious most asked question with regard to Genesis 15. Once we got done with that, we went off to 1 Peter 3:18 through 22, which is the proclamation of Jesus Christ, which most commentators agree occurred between Christ's crucifixion and His ascension. What I mean by that is that Christ went somewhere, and He went, most agree, it's my view, that He went down and made a proclamation in front of the demonic realm, or the fallen angels of Genesis 6, and made a statement to them, very much like the statement of the released goat of Leviticus 16. And of course, the obvious question becomes, when He did that in between His crucifixion and His resurrection, is that got a two-bird issue? In any event, after journeys through Naaman and Gehazi and Elisha and the floating iron axe head in the Jordan and Joshua and the ark in the Jordan and the two memorial remembrances, one that remained in the Jordan, and that of course is fascinating. Why did they leave it in the Jordan where no one could see it? Why does it stay in the Jordan? Obvious question is, what else stays in the Jordan? And the other one, the other stone memorial, of course, is at Gilgal, and Gilgal means the place of rolling, the place of removing away by rolling. That's what Gilgal means, because He rolled away the Egyptian stain, if you will. Then after that, we moved on and looked at the signs of Moses again, the great signs of Moses, particularly the white as snow, leprous hand sign. And that, of course, makes us look at Miriam and Aaron, which makes a lot of sense because of Gehazi. Everybody with me? Good. And having endured all of the aforementioned, you are now completely qualified to continue on to where we are now, today. And that isn't all 83, is it? How many I got? That isn't all 82, is it? That's about 15 of the 82. But you're now qualified to continue today, understanding fully the logical progressions of how we got here. And if you don't understand it, and that's okay, but you have to have a plan if you don't understand, and your plan is to do what your neighbor is doing, which is to pretend you understand. And occasionally, you have to nod your head knowingly, not asleep. Some of you do that, but knowingly. You need kind of an impatient air about it that implies the lecturer, that would be me, is merely presenting the elementary, the obvious. And it's perfectly okay, because church and pretending have long been a partner. I'll look around someday. So, where are we? A quite common chorus that echoes from the cliff inside congregation. We are at the mystery of the brain and the mind, or the mind and the brain, to say it better. Or the mind-brain problem. What is the difference between the mind and the brain? One is metaphysical, one is physical. And I put it all on the board last week, and there's your list, and it's in your bulletin. If you don't have a bulletin, you're probably going to need one, at least for the purpose of the list. I might add a few things to the list, and there is a need for you to be literate in all of these items with the terminology, with the nomenclature, and I'm going to slow down a little bit. I thought I could pull this off in three. I don't think I can now. I think I'm going to end up doing four, maybe five lectures in order to get it. But this is the metaphysical and the physical. The science of being is what we're talking about now. The science of reality, what's called ontology. I don't know if ontology is on there. Doesn't look like it is, but you need to know the science of being, or the science of knowing, or the science of reality is called ontology. And eventually this becomes a collision of philosophical thought and discussion. It's going to be a collision of radical dualism versus monistic functionalism. And as I said last Sunday, this is by far the greatest drool fest of my pastoral career. There's no question about it. There's no disputing it. And I had all kinds of ideas of how to try to mitigate this, how to make it so it was palatable to you. It's only a lack of funding that kept me from buying everyone little plastic buckets to hang around your neck to catch the saliva. I really wanted to kind of pass them out, something on the side. I survived. I survived Chronister's metaphysical physical lectures. I thought maybe brightly covered bibs. That'd be a good idea, and pillows and footrests and little blankies. So I didn't do it. I didn't do it because I had to consider the funding, and I also had to consider that you would demand the same for all subsequent Sundays. Because once an entitlement is given, once a benefit is distributed, it's very hard to get it back. People won't give up their Social Security. Anyway, we began this discussion as we should. I rattle off all that other stuff to let you know how we got here. And you may not know how we got here by all those other means, but hopefully you will by the time we're done. But we began the discussion of the mind-brain problem the way we should, the way everyone does. This is what you get. Jack is not here, but Jack came to see me this week, and I told him, if you show up, and he's flying, what is he doing, helicopter stuff today, right? But I said, if you show up, I'm going to stand you up and make you tell this group what it's like to go through this discussion at UAA. And he'll tell you, it freaked him out. But then it got to be very, very important to him, to where he began to value how it really worked. And we talked about this almost 3.5-4 hours. And you will. But we began this discussion as we should, as everyone does, with the metaphysical implications of the subatomic diameter. Now, let me repeat that. We began this like we're supposed to. The metaphysical implications of subatomic diameter. That's right here. Now, that might not mean anything to you yet, but hang on. Here we go. Last Sunday, we put on our new list, which is on the board and in your bulletin, and I promised that every one of you would eventually be able to define each term and explain how they connect, why they're on the board, and how they fit with the other terms, how they build the case for the existence of the metaphysical. That's what I'm doing. I'm building the case for the existence of the metaphysical, which means that I am building the case for the existence of your soul. I'm going to prove to you as best I can that you have one, in case you didn't think so. Or in case you ever sit alone in your bed and wonder if you do. Or if someone dies and you wonder what happened to them. I think it is absolutely essential that the church be able to deal with that. Well, who else is going to deal with it? The metaphysical, it's defined as that which is knowing and being. The intangible, the unseen, that's what metaphysical means. Metaphysical reality, then, is the soul and the spirit, the existence of the soul and the spirit, the immaterial. The physical being the material. And thus, last week's sermon title. Unification Theory for the Reconciliation of Physical Matter and Metaphysical Reality. My favorite seeker-sensitive Easter sermon. This, again, is the mind-brain problem. One is physical. Which is physical? The brain is physical. It is, we cut you open, take it out, put it on the desk. There's your brain. The mind, however, is metaphysical. The mind is the unseen. And this is the reconciliation of the physical and the metaphysical. The mind-brain problem. Hopefully some of that made sense for those who remained conscious last week. Because this is review, isn't it? By the way, consciousness must also be determined. You got to know what consciousness is. What are the features of consciousness? How does consciousness exist? Why does consciousness exist? So you not only have to stay awake, you got to evaluate how it is that you know something while you're staying awake. It's kind of a little trick. If, however, you were absent or heretofore nothing yet has any significant meaning, I get it. I realize that's probably the case for the overwhelming majority of you, but I urge you to keep coming, keep trying to understand. This is very important. Someday, somebody is coming to you that is dying, and they're going to want to know what happens next. How do you know it happens? Prove to me what's going to happen. Where do you have this information? Where does it come from? One of the biggest challenges I have here is the death of an animal. You're going to have to explain death of an animal. You need to know. This is knowing. This is knowing the marvelous way we are constructed, how we function, the interaction of the mind and the brain, or the mind and the body. This is essentially Abraham's great question in Genesis 15, which is laid out by the two birds, the heifer, the goat, and the ram. He says, how can I know I will inherit eternal life? How can I know it? This is about knowing and being. That's what we're dealing with. You see, you will, and you already have, confronted those who deny the existence of the soul spirit. You're going to meet somebody today. Those who believe that only physical matter exists. Those who believe they are a purely physical process. In which case, they will cease to exist upon the physical process no longer functioning. So when physical death comes, their existence ends at that point. There are those who believe that. And they dominate academia. They dominate The education system. They dominate the media. And their life is purposeless because they believe the universe has no purpose. It is just physical matter that spontaneously erupted and has no design. And therefore, their life, their matter, their physical, is also purposeless and meaningless, and nothing has purpose. All is time, all is chance, and physical matter is simply the result of time and chance. And as you know, that is what we call atheistic evolutionism or Darwinianism, atheistic Darwinianism. And it dominates scientific thought, and it dominates educational thought, and it dominates our cultural media. If you conclude that all you are is physical matter that has no purpose, that the body is the only part, there is no spirit, soul, there is no immaterial, there is no metaphysical, if all there is a physical, there's only one part. There's only one part, the body. That is called what? And we look at the board with an air of understanding. Yes, that is called monistic. Monistic, or monism, monistic functionalism. One thing, only the body. All Darwinian atheists are monistic. Yes. Am I going to separate animals from humans? Yes. How am I going to do it? I'm going to follow Dr. E. D. Buckner, who wrote The Immortality of Animals in 1905, and it is still the preeminent work on the subject. There are others, Walford, Zuck, who follow his line of reasoning. It is a Hebrew word study on living soul. Yes. Now, you're going to knock me completely off. I got 13 pages. How much? $33? Okay, I would recommend any of you who are serious students of Scripture, which I hope is all of you, should own that book. Is it an easy book? Oh, no, baby. Bring a lunch. Okay. To conclude, let me go back here. To conclude that you are, that we are physical matter purely. We do not have an immaterial part to us. To conclude that the body is the only part, there is no spirit or soul in it, that is monism. Monistic materialism or monism. It is also called something else. So in your little place, it's called hedonism as well. Monism and hedonism are almost interchangeable today. Now, you might know what hedonism is. Why is monism or monistic materialism or the belief that the body is the only thing, how does that relate to hedonism? Is hedonism a good thing normally in our society? No, it's not. It has a bad connotation. What is hedonism essentially? It is this. It is that because there is only a physical, because there is only a body, there is no soul, there is no spirit, because there is just simply a body. Darwinianism, only one part. Atheism, only one part. No soul, no metaphysical. It's certainly logical to conclude that if the body is all that exists, then pleasing the body, pleasing the physical, is all that can be accomplished. Wouldn't that make sense? So monism immediately you become a hedonist. And you go about pleasing yourself because there's nothing else. There's no other purpose. And note the current condition of our culture, by the way. Note our advertising. It's all monistic. There is no spiritual. There is no accountability. There is no issue at all spiritually. It is all about our soulless body. One part. And it's the design. There's consequences to beliefs, you know. It's the design of monistic materialism to create a selfish, hedonistic society. It's their goal. That's what atheistic Darwinism does. That's its design. When you get into the philosophers of it, even the scientific community, they will tell you, as I said last week when I quoted Aldous Huxley, they will say to you, we want Darwinianism because of the release from the moral implications of the metaphysical. We want monism. We want only one part because now we can focus on ourselves. It's liberating. Talk to a evolutionist. It's liberating. The only thing for him to do is to please himself. And hopefully you recognize the absolute opposition to Darwinian hedonism that is your Bible, that is Scripture. The Bible condemns Darwinian hedonism, which is why the Darwinian hedonists hate the Bible and hate the Christian community. It only makes sense. Now, as an aside, there are other philosophies concerning the body and the soul spirit, Gnosticism being one. Gnosticism says the physical is evil, and the spiritual or the immaterial or the metaphysical is good. The body, therefore, is a prison to the Gnostics. Jehovah's Witness would fall under the Gnostic category. They don't want to resurrect the body. They don't believe Christ was bodily resurrected because the body is evil to them. That's why they don't believe Christ is God, because the God that created the body must be what? Must be evil. He created something evil, so there's another God way up there. You'll see Mormonism creep in now. We have the real God, then we have the other gods, and then we have some more gods, and then eventually you'll be a God. You'll be a God step four. You know, it's kind of like the military. The real God is the E9, right? Chief Master Sergeant. Right, everybody knows that. You have people that think they're God, but they're an E5. They're not really God. Yeah, those are O3s. You see the system. Different different levels of God. Excuse me. Now I realize this is very difficult. This is philosophy. I'm giving you a philosophy, a college level philosophy introduction here as best I can. And I know that it requires, like anything else, a lot of terminology, a lot of time thinking about it. I'll force you to do it. That's why I want you to keep coming back, because your children are facing this every day in school. Your grandchildren. And they're going to want to know. And you're going to have to be able to swipe aside that which is predominant nowadays. How difficult is it, by the way, to knock it apart? Oh, it's very easy to knock it apart. Darwinianism, hedonism cannot stand even the smallest bit of scrutiny. Okay, again, the Bible opposes Gnosticism, because the Bible says the body will be resurrected. So that's your number one thing whenever the Jehovah's Witnesses knock on your door and start talking about Gnosticism. Well, now, we left off last week at the metaphysical implications of quantum physics, or what's called subatomic diameter. And I got up here with a cue ball, and I explained to you that if the cue ball represented the nucleus, which is the protons and the neutrons of the average atom, that the electron would be over 3 miles away from it. And so that if I was able to magnify it 10,000 or times, I would be able to get it to this place where the cue ball represented the nucleus, then the electron almost 3 miles away. And so there is a metaphysical implication to that, because essentially atoms are empty space. Complete empty space. We'll get to more. Quantum physicists are even proposing that it goes further than that. They're going to tell you that particle-based mass is non-existent, all but non-existent. There is no particle-based mass. So what am I talking about now? I'm asking the question, what is real? Classical Newtonian physics. versus quantum physics. Classical Newtonian physics says everything is got mass. Everything is a particle-based mass. The quantum physicist says nothing is. There is no particle-based mass. It's all but non-existent. They say that electrons are structureless. And they conclude that they're clouds of negative electromagnetic energy. And then we go down to superstring theory. See, I'm going to start clipping these off for you one at a time here. We go down to superstring theory. If superstring theory is correct, they're going to conclude that there's no such thing as any particle-based atomic mass. General quantum physics, if correct, will state that the atom is 1% particle-based mass. 1%. That means 99% is what? Nothing. Welcome to philosophy class. The nature of the subatomic structure compels us to address the fundamental question of matter. Here's what we know with certainty about physical matter. We know this with certainty. We absolutely know this. This is what we know about physical matter. That it is only infinitesimal charges of electricity and vast amounts of nothing. That's what we know physical matter is. Somebody comes to you and says, I only believe what I can see, what I can touch, what I can feel, what I can hold. You tell him that he can see, he can touch, and he can hold nothing. All he can hold is infinitesimal little tiny charges of electromagnetic energy. The rest of it is vast amounts of empty space. This is the core of physical reality. Nothing. That's why I say the metaphysical implications of empty space. If physical reality is predominantly empty space, which these guys will say it is, and they just mock the Newtonian physicists now. It's just amazing to read them. But if physical reality is empty space, if your chair is empty space, I wish I had Jack here. Jack would stand up and say, I learned that I don't exist, the chair doesn't exist, the floor doesn't exist, the building doesn't exist, I can touch nothing, see nothing, and nothing exists. All we have is empty space. Doesn't that pretty much sum up what he said to you? The core of physical reality, if you are a physical realist, the core of your physical reality is empty space, nothing. So again, consider the implication. Physical matter is empty nothingness. And I would expect that, wouldn't I, being a Bible guy, reading the Bible? Because what's God? He's spirit. He's metaphysical. He doesn't describe you. Make no image of me. I'm metaphysical. It's one of your commandments. And he said he spoke this physical into existence from what? Nothing. And so nothing is a big part of this physical. He not only spoke the physical into nothing, but 1% of it is particle-based mass. If we are quantum physicists, if we're string, superstring theorists, none. The rest of it is what? Nothing. He used a whole lot of nothing. I'd expect that from him. Now, if there is no physical reality, or at best a 1% physical reality, then what's the obvious question? What's left? What remains? And again, this is here. The metaphysical implications of the subatomic diameter. When I say subatomic diameter, for those who weren't here last week, you have a nucleus, right? And I have an electron. What's the electron? It's a cloud of electromagnetic energy. It's not even a particle. Okay? The subatomic diameter is that. It's not the diameter of the neutron. I'm sorry, of the nucleus. It's the diameter of the atom, which is the, if you will, the orbit of the electron. And as I told you, if this were the nucleus, if I blew it up to where the nucleus was this big, the electron would be 3 miles away and nothing in between but empty space. Yes? Are the same. This is a general reference. He's correct. I have some that would be 20 miles away. I have some that would be 2 miles away. But by and large, most would be about 3 to 4 miles away. If you allow me my analogy. So the subatomic diameter is essentially empty space, and now you have to say to yourself, if physical reality is empty space, what is the metaphysical implications of that? What then is reality? If reality is not physical, then what is reality? It must be what? Must be spiritual. Reword this another way. Because all mass, and thus the entire universe, and all that is in it is made of atoms, and atoms are essentially 99% empty space and infinitesimal interactions of electromagnetic energy and information, the obvious question is necessarily evoked. What is reality in the physical sense? Now, I've reworded that and banged it in 4 or 5 times in a row. How am I doing? Ready for your test? What is the metaphysical implications of empty space? That's the question. Now remember, the spiritual truth. Remember that. The Bible is very clear. The Bible says we are not our body. Very clear. Our identity is not our physical body. Repeats it over and over again. We are our soul. Our identity, our knowing, our being is not physical. It's metaphysical. Bible says it over and over again. Stated this way. I am not my body. This is not Steve Chronister. That is not Dave Stahl. That's not Kathy Andronese. We are not our bodies. Bible tells us that. We are our soul, our identity, our knowing, our being is metaphysical, not physical. That's why when you say, how can I know, you are not talking physically, you are talking metaphysically. Abraham's question is about knowing. Knowing is metaphysical. Stated this way again, I am not my body, I am my soul. Descartes said this, I think, therefore I exist. Very important. Our consciousness does not depend on our physical status. It is not a product of a physical process or processes. Our consciousness is the product of a spiritual process. And that spiritual process continues beyond the end of the physical. And the Bible doesn't stutter here. It is unequivocal. It is positive. It does not give any opportunity for any compromise here. That is why when people die, they come to you. When they're dying, they come to you. People die. They want to know, am I going to cease to exist? And your answer is unequivocal from the Bible. No. The Bible is positive. And as comforting as that is this is, there's more questions than are raised. If there is no physical reality, or at best there's a 1% physical reality, then what is reality in the metaphysical sense? What is metaphysical or spiritual reality? And once you get past that, how do these extremely different divergent systems, the physical and the metaphysical, how do they interact? What is common between the metaphysical and the physical? And now we are talking about radical dualism. How is it that the metaphysical reacts to the physical? How does my mind interact with my brain? Who's in charge? It is obvious that in a teenage boy that the physical is in charge. No, seriously, the mind is the controlling system. That is your identity. That is who you are. You are the spirit soul. This question comes up all the time. If the physical is 1% real, then is the metaphysical 99% real? Is that how God's designed it? Another question. What is the mystery of physical mass interacting with spiritual reality? And then, of course, I get this all the time. What is real? And that is what I am endeavoring to answer here. That's what I'm trying to do. What is real? It's given to me another way. I'm admonished a lot to get real. And so this is my response to those of you who tell me that. My attempt to comply. We're getting real. Or like I like to say a lot, I'm answering what is really real. Really. Which leads us to that question that is now the church motto. Were you weird before you came to Cliffside? Or did Cliffside make you weird? I've answered that for 95% of you. Ultimately, this is going to lead us into a discussion of the intermediate state. And that's where we're going to conclude today. You can note that I repeated a lot of things, and you can understand why, I hope. But ultimately, this leads us to a discussion of the intermediate state. What is the intermediate state? You can participate here. Yeah, actually, that you're right on the number there, but except it, let me put it this way. The intermediate state is the state of existence after death and before resurrection. That's called the intermediate state. And there are three different states for mankind. There's birth to death, state one. All of you, I can say pretty conclusively, are in state one. You're in condition one. Intermediate state, state two, is death to resurrection. State three, resurrection to eternity. Does that make sense? Death to resurrection is the intermediate state, or state two, the second state. Note that all mankind, all men, all women, have three states. We all have three states. However, the destiny or the destination is different for believers and unbelievers. Where you reside, resurrection to eternity. Where you reside, death to resurrection is different. So the destiny. Okay, the best passage for the intermediate state is Matthew 17. So we go there now. We're starting the sermon. Should only take a few more hours. Actually, when I wrote this today, I told Laura, I said, uh-oh. I have the same number of pages that I used to have years and years and years ago. That's not good news without those little buckets that I was considering. Matthew 17, what is that? That's the transfiguration. We are talking about the intermediate state or the state between death to resurrection. Now, after 6 days, why 6 days? Why not? Never mind. Now, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John. Why Peter, James, and John? Never mind. His brother led them up on, John, his brother, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light, and behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. This is where Christ makes it obvious to these three disciples, and the others were over here, by the way. He makes it obvious to them that he is God himself. Kind of like Superman, he opens it up, and they can see that he is the Shekinah glory. He is the burning bush light. He is the Shekinah glory that was in the tabernacle. And He lets them know without any possibility of doubt that He is God in the flesh. Now, what makes this so very interesting, though, with regard to the intermediate state, is Moses. He's the key to understanding a lot of what's going on here. Because Moses is what?
Who's here?
Peter, James, and John, God, Elijah, and Moses. So if we're doing the Transfiguration play, who would like to be God? Don't raise your hand. I mean, my goodness. No. Let's at least hire somebody to be blasphemed and cast into hell. Let's not do it ourselves. Pick the dumb guy. Pick the guy that asks the dumb question. That's typecasting for all of us. Okay. Moses is the only one who is physically dead. Moses is in the second state. He's in the intermediate state. His body is dead. Deuteronomy 34. Elijah did not die. 2 Kings 2. He what? He flew up, right? Ooh. One died, one flew. Elijah did not die. So Moses is in the intermediate state, state 2. What state is Elijah in? State 1, maybe. Now, great disagreement here. Some say Moses is also in state 1, and they say that because of Jude 9, and they say that because of Michael fighting with Satan, and they say that because of the assumption of Moses. And some say Elijah is in state 3, that he is already in a transformed, glorified body. Much contentious debate. And they say all of this because of Revelation 11. Is Moses really dead or is he a Lazarus? A die twice, because that's what Lazarus is, right? Not Lazarus and the rich man, the Pharisee, but Lazarus, brother of Mary Martha. Lazarus, brother of Mary Martha, is what we call a die twice. In other words, he died once, Christ pulled him out, and then he died again. He's a die twice. Is Moses a die twice? That's the question. And they get that because of Jude 9 fighting over the body. Is that, everybody got that? Is Elijah a state 1 or a state 3? What do you think? Now you see why this is so much fun. Do we have Leviticus 14 here? One dead bird and one flying bird. We got that? Do we have one divided bird, Leviticus 1:17, and one released bird? One dead goat? One running off goat, Leviticus 16? Does divided mean dead? Do we count the dog when we count attendance? Yeah, the dog tried to answer. Does divided mean dead, Genesis 15? Does undivided then mean alive? What do you do with Leviticus 1:17 where we have a dead but undivided bird? Okay, so Matthew 17:1-4 is not the best place to work through the intermediate state. Let's go to, I just threw it in there because it's so much fun. And it does kind of take you around and around. Let's go to Luke 16:19. Because this is the other Lazarus. And we've read this many, many times, and I'll hurry through it. There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. And as you know, that's the rich man. And I will make the case that he is not just rich, but he is what we call church rich, which means that he's really rich. And he is a Pharisee. But there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. Yea, dogs, always have a dog in case you got sores. So it was that the beggar died and was carried by the angels. How many angels carried him? To Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died. Same day? Oh, I got a feeling same day. Christ telling this story. Do these men really live? Yes, they did. He would know when they died, didn't he? He's God after all. The rich man also died and was buried. And being in torments in Hades, he lifted up his eyes. What state's the rich man in? He's in the intermediate state. What's he got? He got eyes. And saw. Not only got eyes, he could see. He's in the intermediate state. Abraham. Who's Abraham? Abraham. Guy wants to know. Wants to be metaphysical and not physical. Where's Abraham? He's also in the intermediate state, isn't he? Afar off. And he had Lazarus in his bosom. So I got three guys in the intermediate state here. I've got the rich man Pharisee, I've got Abraham, and I've got Lazarus. Then he cried and said, Father Abraham, who cried? The rich man that's in the intermediate state. Have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. Now, that's a trick question, by the way. That's impugning the omniscience and the goodness and the justice of God. That's a trick. And we've gone over that before. But notice what he can do. He can think. He can cry out. He can feel. He can reason. He's tormented. He can thirst. He thinks Lazarus has a finger. And he's in the what? The intermediate state. But Abraham said, so Abraham can do what? Talk. Son, remember that in your life, what else can Abraham do? He can think. He assumes that the guy can remember. Remember that in your lifetime you received your good things and likewise Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted. So Lazarus can be comforted and you are tormented, which means you can feel what? Pain, physical pain. But you're in the intermediate state. And besides all this, between us and you there is a great gulf. So those who want to pass from here to you cannot, nor those can those from here pass to us. Then he said, I beg, he can beg, that you would send. I have five brothers. Testify. I got one thinking guy here, and he has no what? He has no body, physical body. He has no physical status, no physical process at all. He's in the intermediate state. I wish I had time to go to Samuel. Samuel 28, 12 through 19, maybe next week. But note that the rich man looks like who? Who's he look like? He looks like the rich man. Looks like himself, doesn't he? He has no physical body. He's in an intermediate state. Abraham looks like who? Abraham. Lazarus looks like Lazarus. You go to Samuel. Samuel looks like Samuel. They look the same. They're recognizable. They're in the intermediate state. What's real? Who are they? They are not their physical body, obviously. They are their soul spirit. Soul spirit then has the same appearance as the body in the intermediate state? Moses, what's he look like? He looked like Moses. Elijah looked like Elijah. How are they recognized? I always ask that question. Old photographs? You know, here's Peter standing there. Who's that? Well, hey, I got this old photograph of Moses. I think that's your Moses. Is that name tag? Name tag. Hey, good thinking. Actually, I do have kind of the name tag position. See, how did they know that it was Moses? They'd never seen Moses and Elijah. Peter never saw Moses and Elijah. He knew that was Moses and Elijah. Was he right? He was right. How did he know? It couldn't be, like I said, that he has a portrait of Moses and Elijah. Like we have a portrait of Christ in our houses, don't we? How can we be so dumb? But we are. Oh, all the time. Hey, that's a cup with a picture of Christ on it. No, it's a picture of Robert De Niro. It's a picture of Fred. You don't know what Christ looked like. Why do we always, and we all get all upset. Woo, he's the fame, the picture of Christ. Look at him, spray painted on it or something. It's not a picture of Christ. It's some silly guess by somebody who's stealing your money because he thinks you're what? Yeah. Because he thinks you are stealable. It's stealification. It is today. Anyway, how did they know that it was Moses and Elijah? I'm getting off. They is either their stuff or what they said because they heard them talk to Christ. Now, if Moses is a state two intermediate state, he can talk. And he can be heard by those in state one. And he has stuff. Somehow they figured out who he was. And one thing, some things are obvious. The spirit can function without the body. The metaphysical can function without the physical. Here's a great question. Can the physical function without the metaphysical? Radical dualism. I'm ending up in all kinds of strange places. I got to cover them all, and it'll just add to my reputation for being strange, and it's okay. It's pretty much full to the brim anyway, so nothing's going to stay in there. Full consciousness, the ability to carry on conversations, to feel things emotionally, to feel things psychologically, to be tormented, to feel, to be comforted, to feel things physically, to think, to reason, to know, to interact. The Bible says the metaphysical is real. Science says the physical is empty space. There's your debate. There you are. One more full page. We'll skip a bunch of it. There's a whole bunch of questions now raised about John 4, 24 through 26. Here's the key to how, you know, I get told all the time, you don't do applicational stuff. Here we go. Smack them upside the head with it. 4:24 John, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Jesus said to him, I who speak to you am. There is no he in there. Capitalize the am. God is spirit, and those who worship must worship in the metaphysical and truth. Did you think the spirit was some kind of emotional feeling? He's spirit. You have to understand that he's spirit, and he must be worshiped spirit to spirit. It isn't a feeling. Feelings are what? Physical. And in the sense that they're manifested, your animation is physical, not your emotional feeling. Those who worship must worship in metaphysical and truth. And Christ is the I Am. What does all that mean? Come next week. Have no predisposed concepts. We will keep going.